The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The humanitarian crisis that is the civil war in Yemen is our focus. It rages on between the Saudi-led coalition. The U.S. is part of that Saudi-led coalition, we should point out, and the Shiite Houthi rebels are on the other side. Last weekend, attempts to renew a 72-hour ceasefire intended to allow humanitarian aid into the country disintegrated after Saudi-led airstrikes were conducted on a Houthi stronghold of Sana'a, Yemen's largest city. On Tuesday, a United Nations envoy delivered a peace proposal to the Iran-allied rebels in Sana'a. No response yet. Is Yemen the new Laos, poorest country in the region? Locked in a secret war that no one can stop, and a famine growing, millions of its citizens in a state of malnourishment or actual starvation. Reports have also emerged that Saudi Arabia is deliberately targeting farms and the state's agricultural industry. In a moment, we'll hear from one father struggling to hold his family safely together in Yemen's capital city of Sana'a. But first, we go to Adam Barron, who was based in Yemen as a journalist from 2011 to 2014. He's now a visiting fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations, a researcher at the Institute for Social Anthropology. He says the people who want the war to end have no voice on the international stage.
I mean, that's really the unfortunate thing, is you have certain people that speak in the name of the Yemeni people. The internationally recognized president, Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, will speak in the name of the Yemeni people. Abdelmalek al-Houthi, the leader of the Houthi movement, will speak in the name of the Yemeni people. But who is actually speaking for the Yemeni people? Who is actually willing, speaking towards the true concerns of the Yemeni people who want the war to end, who would like to have enough food to eat, who would like to have the ability to travel in and out of the country? And, you know, unfortunately, there's no one doing that. And I think part of the issue is you do see this real lack of interest from Western actors in this conflict, despite the fact that the West is deeply involved in this conflict. When you look at the bombs that are being dropped in Yemen, these are U.S. bombs. These are British-made bombs. In some cases, these are European-made bombs. You know,
these are bunker busters. These are cluster bombs. I mean, I've seen pictures of all kinds of munitions with U.S. serial numbers in Yemen, and I don't see a lot of boxes of U.S. cheese and food in Yemen.
I mean, that's a huge issue as well. But I think part of that is, on the one hand, yes, I completely agree that there's a need for a humanitarian mission to go into Yemen and greater humanitarian aid. But in the absence of an end to the war, and particularly in the absence of the end to the blockades that are preventing the blockades and blockages that are preventing Yemen from being part of the global economy, that are, for example, preventing a country that imports 90% of its food from receiving shipping from the majority of its key ports. In the absence of that, humanitarian aid is basically a drop in the bucket. When we're dealing with these numbers where 80% of Yemenis, 80%, 20 million people are in need of humanitarian aid, hundreds of thousands, I think the latest number is 850,000 Yemeni children are malnourished. These are numbers that just humanitarian aid alone will never deal with. This is something that will only be dealt with in terms of an end or at the very least a de-escalation of the conflict. And the unfortunate thing is, you know, even if the conflict ends today, Yemen will be facing the effects of this. Just on a humanitarian, on a health level, Yemen is looking at a lost generation, a situation where you will be facing the effects of this for decades to come.
Well, I can hear the frustration in your voice, and I have to say that I share it as I try to even, you know, formulate questions on this conflict in Yemen. But what if you were explaining to a child inside Yemen who's, you know, educated, who, you know, there are people in Yemen who aren't necessarily in poverty, but, you know, that said, there's famine all over the country. How would a father explain to his kids why there's a war?
Yeah, I think it's just this tremendous selfishness, this short-sightedness of people of powerful people working for their own interests in terms of rather than working for the good of the people. And what you see is literally a country being ripped apart at the shreds. it's hard. As someone that lived in Yemen for 3 years, who considers Sana'a, you know, home, considers most of Yemen my home, it's something very hard to comprehend. It's something just really hard to sort of deal with, that this place that once existed, that, you know, in a lot of senses no longer exists. The Yemen that was no longer is. And what we're seeing now is really a rapidly deteriorating situation that, in the absence of some sort of de-escalation, in the absence of some sort of end of the conflict, will only get worse.
Adam Barron is a visiting fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. He's a researcher at the Institute for Social Anthropology. He spoke with us from Vienna. Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wars in our time have windows. Via our computer screens or other means, we can peer in to see a country being torn apart in nearly real time. Sounds of Sana'a, Yemen's capital, early this month. The bombing, people collecting bodies, fighting fire. You can see it all, but you can't help. It's also possible in wars of our time to hear the voices from inside Yemen. For instance, a father answering that question, why are they bombing? Mohammed al-Assadi is father of four, his son Yusuf, who's only three, his daughters, who are 12, 14, and 15. They ask that question every day. And so, Mohammed wrote this essay on his daily life for our partner, The New York Times, and read it for us.
My son Yusuf calls the bombings fireworks. He sinks in fear when explosions wake us up from sleep. He runs to the person closest to him to hide. My little boy will be 3 in December, but he's already 3 years old. During one of our evening meetings, I asked my 3 daughters to write about what is happening around them. My oldest, Khulood, who is 15, wrote, "We the children of Yemen want to achieve our hopes, to study and play and achieve our goals. We sleep afraid, we wake up afraid, and leave our homes afraid." When the bombs are close enough, the shock waves shake the house badly, blowing open doors and windows. It feels as if the explosions are inside your ears. My son and youngest daughter, Hanin is 12, wake up screaming, running in all directions through dark rooms. My wife and I have agreed on a division of roles. She takes care of our little boy, who sleeps in our room. I take care of the girls in the room next door. The first words we tell them are, "You are fine. We are all fine. The blast is far away from our house. Don't panic. We are all okay. You are okay." I gather them all together and we make a group hug. If the night is particularly bad, we all sleep together. Way back when the war started, I explained to my daughters what is this all about, who is fighting whom and why. They understand that we are not a direct target for any of the fighting parties, but could be collateral damage should we happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. So, we limit our movements. My children call this under house arrest. Asma, who is 14 now, is the first to spend money and the last to save it. She loves children and her friends. I cried when I read what she had written for the Facebook post. We are afraid of catastrophe, as it is painful when a person kills others, mothers, fathers, and children. It is as though the people's consciousness are like stones, and every person with authority does what he wants. Hanin, the 12-year-old, is outspoken and creative. She is always asking what things have not yet been invented because she says she wants to invent something. She wants to invent something that will benefit everyone. Once, when I apologized for being late because I was at work helping the children of Yemen, she confronted me we are also the children of Yemen. Here is an excerpt from her Facebook essay. The situation is getting worse daily. Our studies have stopped. Playing is forbidden. They cut off the water and electricity in all the residents. Every day, the noises get louder and louder next to us. However, I have two questions that are confusing me. How will our future be beautiful if they have destroyed Yemen? How will this war end? And Yemen will be liberated and the future will be beautiful, God willing. End of quote. My children were at home when the bombs killed more than 100 people at the Sana'a funeral hall. On my way back home, I saw the lines in one hospital. People were looking for their loved ones. My children learned about the attack hours later, once they had finished all their homework. They always have questions. They asked me if any of my friends had been killed. I told them one, the mayor of Sana'a. They were in a state of shock. I checked their homework to keep busy. But as soon as they went to bed, an airstrike rocked our house. Two more followed. I moved from their room to the middle of the house. They sleep next to each other on the same mattress, where I can hug them all if an airstrike hits the area. This is life in a war zone. Every day you wake up to an unpleasant surprise, the death or injury of a friend or a family member. You witness the destruction of your childhood neighborhood, school, and the little shop where you once bought candy. You have to live without electricity, water, fuel, social services. You don't want to live a life where your utmost achievement is surviving another day, and your ultimate pleasure is having an uninterrupted internet connection. Wars are destructive not only to towns and cities, but also to souls.
Mohammed Al-Assadi is a father of four in Sana'a. He's a former journalist, now working in communications for UNICEF. Do we really know how the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, really feels about Brexit? Well, you have to listen pretty closely, it turns out.
I think being part of a 500 million population trading bloc is significant for us. I think one of the issues is a lot of people will invest here in the UK because it's the UK in Europe.
Those are tapes recorded badly, as you can hear, in a meeting between Theresa May and Goldman Sachs. People will invest here in the UK because it is the UK in Europe, she says in that private meeting last May before the Brexit vote. Sounds like she would rather stay in the European Union, don't you think? Business interests told after the vote that the government had a plan for an orderly exit from the union are now seeing chaos and uncertainty radiating from number 10 Downing Street. There are renewed considerations to move business headquarters from London to continental Europe, and May is being accused of not having a clear plan as the UK aims to figure out its fiscal budget for the upcoming year. She's been saying different things to placate everyone on Brexit. Rowena Mason broke the tapes for The Guardian and joins me now. Rowena, nice work.
Thanks very much. Yes, it was the tapes came to me and a colleague, Nick Hopkins, at The Guardian. And what we found interesting about them was that Theresa May, during the EU referendum campaign, her publicly stated position was that she was in favour of remaining, but she really wasn't very vocal about that. She was thought of as sitting on the fence, so much so that an advisor to David Cameron actually thought that she could be an enemy agent, he described her as, for the other side. So what's interesting about these tapes to Goldman Sachs is that she is making her rhetoric is much stronger in favour of staying in the EU and warning about the economic consequences of leaving the single market in particular.
Do you think they show her being naive, or do they show her just playing, you know, backbench Tory politics with the British economy?
I think it's not necessarily a naivety. It's perhaps that during the referendum campaign, if we think back to that time, senior politicians thought that the UK was going to vote to stay in, and what Theresa May was doing was hedging her bets. She wasn't very vocally campaigning to stay in because she thought that there was still a possibility that the UK could come out and that there would be a vacancy for the post of Prime Minister. So she was leaving her options open, and perhaps she foresaw it better than people like David Cameron, the former Prime Minister, and George Osborne, the former Chancellor, who were convinced that the UK was going to vote to stay in. Theresa May was perhaps played in more of a canny way, because she, when the time came for a leadership election, she was able to get the Eurosceptics on board with her leadership campaign because she hadn't been so vocally campaigning for Remain in public, that is.
So why is this such a bombshell then?
This is a bombshell because the rhetoric is much stronger. And we knew that her position was in favour of Remain, but she hadn't been going around campaigning for the In campaign like David Cameron and George Osborne, who were willing to lay down their political careers in order to persuade the UK to stay in.
So does that mean that companies really will reconsider, go back to where they were on the day after the vote and forget all the reassurances?
I think it contributes to a sense of real uncertainty in the government, which has not been clear about. It's not been clear about its plan and its strategy for Brexit. You've seen Theresa May say the phrase that's become very mocked in the UK now, Brexit means Brexit. And while that was a sort of holding line for a little while that reassured companies a little bit, it's starting to lose its political usefulness now, because it's there seems to be a vacuum at the heart of where a strategy for leaving the EU should be. And for more evidence of Theresa May's true feelings that she wanted the UK to stay in the EU, for that to emerge, that's going to perhaps revive some of those worries about the economic consequences of what the country is about to do.
These tapes had to be leaked by someone who wants to bring her down, or at least scar her credibility.
I don't think there's much chance of this bringing her down, but what the effect of this is to make her look more uncertain. There's a suggestion there that she might have acted out of political opportunism by being so quiet during the referendum campaign. This evidence that she really did want to fight in favour of Remain, and yet she has put all that aside now. She's going full throttle for Brexit and has surprised lots of people, even Remain politicians who supported her leadership bid. She surprised them all with the kind of ferocity with which she is now pursuing Brexit and saying, we're definitely going to go for this, and that's what the British people wanted.
Well, at the very least, she's probably thrilled that this week is almost over.
Yes, I should think so, although there's not been much reaction from Number 10. It's a hallmark of her political style that she doesn't particularly react to stories very much. She sort of lets them play out around her. And while pulling up the drawbridge is one technique for trying to shut a story down, the other consequence of that is that she's left a vacuum around her, which leads to speculation growing about what she really thinks, and also allows criticism to build up. So you've seen the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, saying that we shouldn't have to rely on leaked tapes to find out what our Prime Minister really thinks. And we've seen a bit of criticism from political parties in Germany about it as well. So it's a story that's really spread and got a lot of interest across the world, and yet Number 10 still has the shutters down.
Well, Rowena Mason broke the story for The Guardian, the tapes of Prime Minister Theresa May speaking to Goldman Sachs before the Brexit vote. She's deputy political editor for The Guardian. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. You get a different view of the U.S. electorate if you just put aside all the national presidential polls and campaign rallies and look at the 163 ballot initiatives in 35 states up for a vote this election season. There are themes of criminal justice reform, changing drug laws, and two conflicting measures on capital punishment in California. Beth Schwartzapfel is a staff writer at the Marshall Project, watching for political trends among voters who are bolder than state legislatures when it comes to crime issues these days.
Well, the interesting thing about ballot measures is it sort of sidesteps legislators who might otherwise be squeamish to tackle something like criminal justice reform. So you might go to a legislator and say, let's let felons be eligible for parole earlier. And a legislator might say, no way am I putting my neck out on a measure like that. But the voters can vote on it directly and sort of leave the legislators out of it. So that's happening across the country in various ways.
So what is a place that could have a really interesting outcome on November 8th?
So Oklahoma is a really good example of this. Oklahoma is not by any measure known as a progressive state in any way. And so the ballot measure that voters will be voting on in November is one that legislators might flee from in a state like Oklahoma. What it does is it defelonizes possession of all drugs, including heroin. Personal use amounts of drugs would become a misdemeanor instead of a felony.
What about bail reform and the question of intake to the criminal justice system and the ways in which that can go terribly wrong as far as becoming a pipeline for incarceration?
Yeah, bail is the next big frontier in criminal justice reform. Tens of thousands of people around the country are sitting in jails awaiting trial. So these are people who are innocent under the law. They have not been convicted of anything. They've been arrested for something. And the judge says, you need to pay $5,000 bond before you can go home. Well, for many Americans, that's just completely out of reach. There's no way they can scrape together that kind of money. And so they sit in jail and wait and wait and wait. And in New Mexico, they're trying to tackle this problem with a measure that does two things. The first thing it does is reiterate what's already law in the state, which is that nobody should be detained in jail before trial because they can't pay bail. Now, it's worth repeating, like, that seems pretty obvious, right? Debtors' prisons are illegal. But it routinely happens around the country. And the chief judge of the New Mexico Supreme Court told me, it's true. It's already the law. But we thought it was really important to enshrine it in the Constitution, this commitment that people should not be held in jail just because they can't afford bail. The other thing it would do is it eliminates the automatic right to bail. Under the current Constitution, the judge has to give you an opportunity to make bail. So if the judge thinks you're too dangerous to release before trial, all they can do is set a bail amount that they guess is too high for you to make.
Are either of these measures or any of the measures that you're looking at possible models for broader nationwide reform in any of these areas of criminal justice?
Certainly, the bail reform measure is an interesting example of what can happen when you try to tackle the issue of bail. There are a couple of jurisdictions that have gone much farther, and they eliminate money bail altogether. Washington, D.C. is a good example of this, where a judge can either release you on certain conditions, like electronic monitoring, or you have to check in with a probation officer, or they can hold you. Money has nothing to do with it. What folks in New Mexico told me is that the bail bond industry, these are people who front you the money for your bond in exchange for 10%, is extremely powerful. They have very serious lobbying efforts going on in the state legislature. And so the results are progress to the people working on this issue, but definitely watered down and not nearly as powerful as in other places.
Beth Schwartzapfel is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And now, cars, people, cities. Can we all get along?
The shape of our cities will change as expanded highway transportation decentralizes our population centers into vast urban areas. With the advent of wider, faster expressways, the commuter's radius will be extended many miles. America will someday be crisscrossed by a network of super speed transcontinental motorways.
It's the 1958 Disney vision of Magic Highway USA, where pedestrians and machines would all live in peace. The reality is more like a menacing image from the Russian avant-garde, a Malevich of cramped spaces and predatory machines.
even though the number of pedestrian deaths in the city of New York today is far below the 952 recorded in 1929. 152 pedestrians and cyclists were still killed in traffic-related crashes last year. What if it could be zero? Why do we tolerate any pedestrian traffic deaths at all? Vision Zero, an initiative started in Sweden, being applied here in New York, aims to eliminate pedestrian deaths by 2024. Peter Norton is a professor of history at the University of Virginia, who says even though Vision Zero sounds ambitious, he says if we built our cities, we can decide to control how cars and people interact.
When people are killed in traffic in public places on public roads, why don't we consider that a public loss the way we consider the deaths of soldiers overseas as a public loss, to be grieved publicly, recognized publicly, and dealt with as a public problem? We used to do that, and we stopped, and we began to privatize these losses. And when we did, they became a lot less important as public issues.
And they became no longer news stories, and you know, you didn't read about it in the paper. And
you can see it. Yeah, you can see it on the newspaper coverage. It starts out as front page news, lots of articles, editorials, editorial cartoons, letters to the editor about these problems, and you can see them disappear over time.
What, as a professor of history, gave you the idea that something like this could be changed? Because it seems as though it's so deeply seated that people are going to tolerate, oh, well, that's just what happens. And now all of a sudden we are in a situation where, no, there's just a hugely heightened awareness.
We've changed before. We changed about 90 years ago from a society that was very intolerant of these sorts of fatalities and injuries, and one that grew to accept them. And that transition wasn't a natural evolution. It was a real effort. And I think we can learn from that effort to change again.
Ultimately, what we've seen in the awareness of there are bike lanes, there are commercial vehicles, there are private vehicles, and there are pedestrians. But we've never really established the priorities of who gets to use the roads. Why is that?
By default, the priority has gone to the fastest, most threatening and intimidating and powerful street user, and that's the driver of the motor vehicle. They didn't always have the assumption behind them that the streets are for them. That was a real revolution and a very contested and messy one, although it's usually presented to us as if it was a sort of natural evolution in response to what people preferred, but it wasn't that simple at all.
In the traffic world, one of the things that we tolerate that I think nobody could ever imagine going away is the fact that in New York, and in most big cities around the country, there are two lanes taken up by parked cars. I mean, if somebody from 100 years ago or 150 years ago were to come and take a look at New York, they would think that it's been taken over by some disease. There's some scourge. The wide lanes, the wide open pedestrian causeways, the walkability is all gone because we tolerate parking. Do you think we'll ever get to the case where people's private vehicles will be stored somewhere else other than the city?
Well, we're seeing more and more calls for exactly that. I think your sort of thought model there, imagining somebody from 100 or 150 years ago looking at our city streets today and how they would respond, is a really useful thing to do, because naturally, inevitably, when you grow up with a phenomenon, the phenomenon will seem normal because it's familiar. And this makes it harder for us to look at it and ask us if it really makes sense. When the automobile began to arrive on city streets 100 years ago or so, you see reactions that are very interesting because they reflect a perspective that's completely changed. In other words, 100 or 110 years ago, the automobile was thought of as kind of an intruder who would be tolerated on condition of good behavior, but an intruder who was still quite burdensome in some ways in terms of the space it took up and also in terms of the new risks that it introduced. The newspaper coverage of the time, the letters to the editor at that time, even the expert traffic reports of the time tend to characterize the automobile as this nuisance intruder that needs to be restricted so that we can continue to use streets well and not squander their space taking care of these enormous vehicles everywhere.
What do driverless cars offer as a potential for radically reorienting the extent to which private and public vehicles share the streets?
Driverless cars could mean all kinds of different things depending on how we use them. I'm surprised sometimes to see reports where driverless cars are presented as if they're a sort of automatic, inevitable solution to problems like traffic congestion and safety. Driverless cars could exacerbate urban sprawl enormously by doubling commuting distances as people figure, you know, my time spent in the car isn't wasted anymore. I can go online, I can do my work, I can play while the car is driving me. So why not drive twice as far to work? And if that happens, we're looking at a city that not only has more sprawl, but also becomes, as a side effect of that sprawl, less walkable, less amenable to bicycling, less amenable to public transportation. There are other driverless car futures that are much better, like, for example, people who have limited access to mobility, they can't drive a car for various reasons, or they just prefer not to own a car, can get a car. So I see driverless cars as a tool that could really help other systems, but I don't think that they are a solution in and of themselves at all.
Peter Norton is an associate professor of history at the University of Virginia and author of Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City.
Build that wall! Build that wall! Build that wall!
What does this idea of a wall really mean? We scream out yes or no to the wall at political rallies in this campaign year, but the wall isn't just an idea for politicians. Why We Build the Wall was a question asked 10 years ago by songwriter and composer Anais Mitchell, long before it became a hit folk opera, Hadestown, is when she first started working on the show. Eventually, it became what you hear there, a deep-voiced overseer in Hades, in a new cast recording calling out to his followers in a scene that is a retelling of the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. Orpheus, the greatest of all singers, who descends into hell to retrieve his wife, Eurydice. Hadestown had a run in New York City earlier this year to rave reviews, and a full cast recording of the show will be out early next year, with four songs already recorded and released. But the myth of Orpheus, plus the mythological epic of this 2016 election campaign, has proved a rich brew for a songwriter who has watched as her little folk song emerged to become an anthem for the embrace and suspicion of walls everywhere.
Very early on, it was always an idea, this wall. And I think partly because the underworld has, you know, you have to cross this threshold between the living world and the underworld. And there's the River Styx, or it's just this journey that has to be taken. And with the underworld representing a kind of land of wealth and security, the wall just made sense. There's, in the Greek mythology, Hades is sometimes called the wealthy one. And I think there's something about him almost like a dragon, you know, in this cave with this wealth, but he's sort of trapped down there. So the wall was always there, but the song, Why We Build the Wall, came a little later in the process. And it was one of those songs, you know, I tend to be a very slow and deliberate writer, and I'll take months and even years to finish something. And that song came really fast.
And, you know, looking at you and listening to you talk, I mean, there is just not a sarcastic, cynical sort of hint in your voice. And yet that song is very cynical and sarcastic. It's sort of double meaning. It's it's got a very sharp blades on it.
Who do we call the enemy? The enemy is poverty, and the wall keeps out the enemy. And we build a wall to keep us free. That's why we build a wall. We build a wall to keep us free.
Because we have and they have not, my children. My children, because they want what we have got.
How did you assemble this wall of so many meanings?
Yeah, I don't even know. I mean, it's a song of kind of this circular political logic of Hades. And it's really a rally with a sort of call and response chorus, which is a very folky thing to do.
But it also speaks to this idea that everybody understands a wall. I mean, when you first heard those rallies of Donald Trump, of it, we're going to build a wall and secure this border and solve all this, you can feel people's, yeah, that'll work.
Mm-hmm.
You can feel their, that's going to work. And there's some of that energy in the song of just, we know what we're doing, it's right. And then as the song proceeds, you realize that the wall is your prison.
Yeah, I mean, and people have been talking about walls for as long as we can remember in human history. And I think it is one of those iconic, archetypal words and images that people grab onto when they're scared, when they're looking for certainty and safety. It's very appealing.
What did it feel like to have the show open and suddenly get responses from theatergoers who were, you know, in the midst of this whole 2015, 2016 moment?
Yeah. It started actually before the show opened. I did a tour, and it actually was a tour that was in partnership with the League of Women Voters. I was playing that song on tour and suddenly realized that it had become new, you know, and I've been playing it for 10 years.
So how did you realize that? How did you?
Just the temperature in the room kind of, you know, and the response afterward. And it was a nonpartisan tour because the League of Women Voters is nonpartisan. And so we were just about getting out the votes among women, among everyone. So I didn't want to talk about the election because of that, but it was sort of obvious and didn't need to be stated. But certainly it did feel like the song was able to be useful for people in a new way. And I think that's always kind of what I'm after as a songwriter, is to write a song that can be useful.
What do people tell you?
I think maybe one thing about it, some people are confused by it, you know, people who don't necessarily grasp that it's ironic or that the sarcasm is embedded in it.
Yeah, it's pro-wall, that's for sure.
Right. Some people have asked, like, is this a pro-Trump song? You know, people who don't know me. And I think but part of what makes it powerful maybe is that it's the asking of a question, really. It's not an answer. It's sort of an exploration, for me anyway. I think when I wrote it, and still there was a thinking of, like, say we took, you know, climate change to its terrifying logical conclusion, and there were just tons and tons of people, you know, looking for higher ground, trying to get into the place of relative safety and security, and we happen to be in that place, and we were behind that wall. Who among us is not going to be behind that wall? You know, it's a very human question.
Is there more Orpheus or more Eurydice inside of you?
Both of those characters live inside of me, certainly. And I think coming out of school when I was in my early 20s and started to work on this thing, I think Orpheus was the main kind of guiding light. And then as I've grown older and sort of lived through different times, and I have a kid of my own now, and that makes, you know, choices all feel different when that happens. I understand Eurydice and her choice to choose safety and security. It doesn't feel frivolous at all. It's I understand why people make that choice.
And in fact, 2016 is about a choice of safety and security. But then after the election, there's so much to do. In many ways, your metaphor of Orpheus is kind of perfect for this unsettling moment that's going to be followed by so much work that has to be done to kind of tide up our wounds here.
Yeah, I think that maybe the main meditation in Hadestown from the beginning, and coming from like the era of the Patriot Act and stuff right up until to now and Donald Trump and the wall, is that security and safety have this real dark side. There's a trade-off, and that it has something to do with the life force and sort of soul. That there are things that have to be given up in order to gain that kind of certainty and control, and just to make sure we're up for whatever trade-offs we're making.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Anais Mitchell is the writer of the folk opera Hadestown. A full cast recording of Hadestown comes out early next year. Everybody keep calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. Comment on our Facebook page at The Takeaway. And thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.